Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and Mr. Money Mustache is guest hosting again today. How are you?
Surprise, surprise.
It's good to see you, man.
Oh, thanks, man. It's great to be in the basement. I'm feeling spectacular today, and I'm also debuting my Mile High Five t-shirt for the first time.
It's a rare when not many people have the asparagus mascot on the front there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and very, very bright green as well. This thing gets a lot of attention, gets you respect on the city streets, and nobody will mess with you with this shirt.
It's great to wear around the produce section of the grocery store. It's a conversation starter if you stand around the asparagus.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. I might try that.
Today is a Q&A episode. So I sent out an email to the Buy Me a Coffee supporters and also to the email list to let people know they could submit questions. And I think we have a bit of a system. We'll have to strategize more, Pete, but we have a few questions we'll answer today. Some are directed at you. Some are things that I wanted to talk about. Like, we got a lot of comments from gamers, people that love video games, on some of our previous episodes where I think as shorthand, we talked down to gamers, which I didn't realize. Well, so we'll get into it.
We'll try not to talk down to people, but I do use that as an example of a lower priority activity.
Yes. And we have some social security questions. You wrote an article recently about that, and there were some people that pushed back. One of the friends of the show, Jesse Kramer.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Always welcome.
And I didn't clear this one with you, but hopefully you can tell us about your latest annual expenses. So I don't know if you know that off the top of your head, but we'll get into it and talk about it. And then if you want to have your questions included, best way to do it is check out the Buy Me a Coffee, because then you're treated with priority because you're a supporter of the show. And the other way is make sure you're on the email list. So when we are gathering questions, that's the easiest way for us to do it. And very much encouraging voicemail. So I got one voicemail, but the topic didn't fit for what we're recording today. So we'll potentially hold it. And it's not a topic area that works for you overall.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It was about border collies specifically.
Oh, I was just going to say, is it about dogs? Because that's definitely a subject I don't know much about.
Yep. So I was like, Elizabeth and I could talk about that. And yeah, I was like, we want to use your brilliant mind for the things that you're brilliant with. So
that sounds great.
Okay. So let's get into it. So this one is from supporter Mike over at Buy Me a Coffee. And we heard you're moving. What factors contributed to your decision of leaving Longmont? And secondary portion is, how has being an empty nester impacted your travel and lifestyle choices?
Yeah. Well, the first one is really just personal reasons. Like, I have a girlfriend who lives in Central Park, which is the name of my new neighborhood. So I figure the Mr. Money Mustache principle is live closest to the activities you do most frequently, or visit people you visit most frequently in my case. But I still wouldn't have moved to a neighborhood if it was somewhere I didn't like. So the real fundamental thing that made this possible is the new neighborhood is like the nicest place I've ever seen in terms of like US, or at least in Colorado, places you can live where everything is just what you want. And I might've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's just like a walker's biker's paradise, and everything's like all gardens and architects drawing, appearing, everything. Like, people are just talking and people bike their kids to school and all that. So I just love the place. And I realized I didn't have to give up Longmont because I still come up here every 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks, and get to go in Mile High Five when I come here, get to visit the co-working space, the HQ. So it really was just a way of shaking things up. And then the second part of the question, which is that I'm not even quite an empty nester. It's more like my son has just been fading into adulthood. He didn't do that like rapid leaping out of the nest and going to college like a lot of people do. So he still lives locally, splits time between his mom's house and my house, but it's more like just having like a really fun, respectful adult roommate, which I like. And of course, I don't have to be there to watch him or feed him anymore. So it does free me up to do whatever I want, but it's not quite the same because I have like a little bit of routine because I like spending time with them. So I like to be around. But the bigger theme that might apply to other people is this is the first time I've moved in 8 years. And I had also lived in Longmont for over 20 years in total. And it's been really good for me, like just to shake up the routine. And I really encourage other people to consider that. I think it's pretty healthy to just, especially as you get older, to avoid just letting everything remain the same decade after decade. It helps to wake up your motivation and your mental circuits and everything. And just because it's been really hard work for me to move to the new house, like dealing with my belongings and decluttering and renovating the new place all simultaneously. And it's good. Like, it's good hard work, which I needed. It's good for me. So I'm really happy I made this move. And I'm going to put my other house up for sale pretty soon, because it turns out I enjoy the new place so much that I no longer feel the need to cling to my Longmont house. Mm-hmm. Long answer, I know, but I'm very passionate about it.
and I like two main things that I'll point out. There are some people in our network that love travel a lot, and there's different ways to do it. You could slow travel. Like, I think the Donegans will get a place for a pretty long time and then like have spurts of faster travel, but they like to set up and like kind of live there, right?
Yeah. And that's a cool way to do it.
And then other folks are like, I like fast-paced travel. They want to be in a new place every day or a couple days or something. But then there's another group of like homebodies. And I think you and I are maybe a little bit more like that. And I enjoy like slow travel and some road trips, but we just got back from a road trip. And boy, it was nice to get back home and just like get into the routine where it's a little bit easier, less willpower is required to live like the healthier lifestyle of food and fitness in that sort of routine.
Yeah.
Where when you're on the road, it's a lot more challenging. You have to make a lot of small decisions that you don't have to make constantly all the time when you're at home.
And that's probably why people like it, is because when you are traveling, there's a lot of problem solving and new experiences, and you're always at a heightened awareness, which makes it kind of thrilling. And time might even feel like it's passing slower because every day is packed with so much stuff. So I get it. And I've done a fair amount of traveling in the past. I just happened to learn what I like, and everyone's wired a little bit differently. So no disrespect to the frequent travelers if they've figured out that
some people like it. Yeah. And then the second portion is around, like you said, just making sort of like a big decision and moving to a new place. You do have to make a bunch of those like micro decisions we're talking about, but it's only a temporary period where you have to do that. But we moved from Atlanta to Bozeman, Montana, which was a huge move, both climate-wise, geographically. We didn't know anyone in town at all. And that's a whole other thing. You get to meet new people, maybe pick up new hobbies or get involved in stuff. And then we moved just 4 years after we moved to Bozeman down here to Longmont. So it's kind of making big decisions where you have to figure a bunch of shit out. It ends up being a pretty good move most of the time. And then, I mean, the more you do it, the more you understand what's working or what's not. So if you did move somewhere, or more likely, hopefully one would test out a city before actually moving there, which we see around here fairly often. People swing by for a few weeks.
I really like that. That's a neat thing about our FI community. The FI collective being the heart of it is like, we get emails from people saying, hey, either by myself or like my wife and I or whoever is thinking of moving to Colorado or Longmont. So we're going to come check it out. Is it okay if we get like a guest membership or a remote membership so we can come and meet some people? And it's really interesting. And a lot of people do end up staying.
Yeah.
Because it's like, figure out what your lifestyle really wants in it.
Next is the gamer lifestyle and video games as a hobby. So we did get a lot of comments on the YouTube side about, I'll just describe it as negative comments about video games. It's a shorthand we use, and I'll let you mention some stuff in a second, Pete, but like Dividend Growth Investing said, no video games after 18. I feel personally attacked. LOL. Yeah.
So we should make sure we're clear. I assume people have seen your past episodes, but in the past, I often dish out like little bits of lifestyle ideas or advice. And I say, like adults should not be playing too many video games, or just because I think of it as similar to TV. And I would encourage people to like put it at the bottom of their list if they're looking to get ahead in other areas of life, because it can get pretty addictive, and just like TV, and you're usually not producing anything. So now this is the pushback from readers and viewers and listeners on that. It's fair. Like, I understand. I didn't mean to make people feel attacked. At the same time, I'd like to hear the next comment was kind of interesting, right? One guy was just joking, I feel attacked.
But yep. then, Yep. And then this one is Ghost Wolf X. You guys have solid takes on the financial efficiency concept side of things, but you're really ignorant about video games. Acting like other hobbies are, quote, better is just so stupid. If you didn't grow up playing them, which Money Mustache even admitted he was 10 years too early for that, then you are simply living in your own past and not fundamentally understanding and following generations' hobbies.
Yeah, well, which is fair, although that person sounds a little angry, which might mean they're like trying to prove a point rather than thinking about it. So I was really into computers and video games. Like, they came into my life when I was about 10 years old, because that's when like home computers started to happen. Like, yeah, 1984, I was 10 years old. So I was fascinated by computers and video games. And that's why I ended up becoming a computer software engineer, because I was so into technology and everything technology stuff is cool and games are part of it. I used to have like a huge collection. I would collect games. I was like, I would run like my own BBS on the modem and pirate games and share them around through the other hackers. So I get it. But why do I make this point about the video games? It's just because it's a sedentary activity and it typically doesn't involve like real world interaction with other humans in nature, which I think is like the most fundamental thing that a human can do that's good for them. So like, if you combine all this, like, I would say the ultimate thing you could be doing is like building a cabin in the woods with your friends and then having like social events and playing music at night and stuff like that. Like, if you take all the things that humans get the most healthy reward from and what we're really wired for. So I'm not saying the video games aren't fun. And the other thing about video games is they're very low cost, right? Like, the gamer culture is that games should be low cost. You get like hundreds of hours of playtime out of a $50 game or whatever. So it's like, it is crazy cheap, but it just, as long as every other box in your life is already checked, like, are you already super fit? Or do you already have plenty of friends? Your job is going great. Your fridge is stocked. Your room is clean. You made your bed. You have the house you want to live in. All your bills are paid and all this stuff. Then at the end of the day, you know, if it's a choice between watching a Netflix show and playing a video game, then absolutely the video game is probably better than that. But if you're doing it for hours and putting other stuff off, which I've done when I was addicted to video games, like certain games, then you might want to question yourself, because it is easy to slide into it. And usually the easy activity that you want to do is the wrong activity. It's quite often the things that you have mental block against are the things that are the best thing for you to be doing in that given moment. And I wrote an article about this called like the ultimate life coach. And it's the idea of catching your brain saying, I don't want to do that right now. And then you do exactly that usually. And that's usually what leads to like the happiest, best life in general.
Well said. And I have two things. So we got an email from Dimitri, which I'll tell you about him in a second, but someone did email in the past, like, hey, do you actually have examples of negative outcomes from someone playing video games? And one of the reasons why it became one of my examples as well is we ended up interviewing people. Carl and I interviewed a handful of folks, and they didn't have much of a structure. So they did play video games shortly after retiring, and it usually didn't work out. Like, they ended up depressed or like, what am I doing? And they had to sort of reset and recalibrate and play fewer video games. So obviously I think those people took it too far. Moderation is key. And Dimitri is a 35-year-old software engineer in Russia, and he really likes the podcast. And he plays about 1 to 2 hours a day of single player games and wanted to know like why we say they're a poor hobby, which you highlighted. But the thing I want to share is he said that it helped him learn English. And he says they're good for the brain as far as solving puzzles and the cognitive benefits of that. And he is the one that did ask about video games backfiring. He had a short note. He's on his Phi journey, although from Russia. And he was like, oh yeah, there's people all over the world listening. So that was the other sort of side point. But appreciate you sending the email, Dimitri, and pretty cool. Yeah, so if you're taking offense to the video game comments, it's not at you directly. It's just like moderation's key. Anything, any hobby could probably be too much if you're obsessive about it.
Yeah. And it's similar to how I encourage people to skip out on a lot of other stuff they like driving to work, for example, and all the other things, candies and junk food and alcohol, like do these things in moderation, but just put them lower on your list because you know they're not going to lead to the best life outcome compared to some other options.
Yep. And I was going to say, like, we all have the thing. I mean, alcohol for me, I'm a beer judge. I brew beer. I probably drink more beer than I should too often. That's an easy thing that I should probably cut out and things would be better. Mm-hmm. But like other things like games, right? There's a social aspect. There's some enjoyment. I'm getting cognitive benefits because I'm analyzing beer as a beer judge. So I could bullshit. I mean, I could justify anything really. So
yeah.
Okay. Next, or anything else on the gaming?
No, it's great. I'm glad people are defending their stuff, and then it's also good to challenge yourself. You know, instead of just challenging Mr. Money Mustache, you could ask for yourself: Are my hobbies the right ones for my dream life? Is it going to create my dream life if I do what I'm doing in this ratio?
Very good. Next is about Social Security. So this is from supporter Rakesh. And he says, hope Pete is enjoying his new neighborhood and having great trips planned in his Model Y. I read his latest blog post on Social Security and pushback from others. So Jesse Kramer, friend of the show, and he's been on the show, I believe, sometime in the past. We'll link up to it. And basically, Pete published your take on Social Security, which I'll let you explain. And then you're actually aware of the pushback because Jesse commented and you replied back. So I may just kind of turn it over to you to lay out what your article was about and then the challenge that Jesse mentioned, and then we can go back and forth.
That sounds cool. And I actually didn't know that Jesse himself had commented and that I had replied. Was it about that same issue with the riskiness?
Yep, and the discount rate. Yep.
Okay, cool. So a quick summary for our listeners here is that I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago. I published it. It's called The Shockingly Simple Math Behind Social Security, playing off popular, one of my more popular earlier blog posts. And in the article, my main point was that even if you're young and you're going to retire early, you can still count on the value of Social Security to help you retire earlier. And it's like a sliding scale. Like if you're 30 years old, your very, very far future Social Security payments are only worth a little bit right now. And if you're 55 years old, you're getting pretty close to eligibility and you've also built up a lot of credits. So that's worth quite a lot. So you don't have to have like your full $1 million retirement stash if you're also getting close to Social Security eligibility. And then I provided a shorthand way to calculate this, which is like called the net present value, where you can estimate the value of a future stream of payments as if you had it today. And it's like, it's not exact, but it's a way of just budgeting so you don't oversave and work way longer than you actually might have wanted to work. So then Jesse, who is a certified financial professional, did an analysis on my blog post and said, and he wrote his own actually, kind of a counterpoint, which is great. I read it. It was well done. It was respectful. And he was saying, I made the mistake of assuming I was comparing the future Social Security value to if I had invested the same amount of money in stocks and how much that would grow. And he said, well, Social Security is a lot safer than a stock investment. So therefore you should compare it to bonds, which changes the numbers in my blog post. So that was his main point. So I agree with the article. Everyone should read it if they're interested in this type of in the weeds stuff, because he makes a good point. And my only counterpoint to that is that, yes, I did think about that when I wrote it, even though I'm sure there's plenty of holes in my other stuff. That was one of the things I did think about. And it's because I don't really think bonds are as valuable as some other people do. And because people think of a guaranteed return, even if it's a low one, as a risk-free return, whereas I don't think that stocks are all that risky. They're volatile, but they're over the long run, they go up quite reliably. And volatility is very different from risk for me, even though financial professionals are often trained to calculate volatility and saying that's the same as risk. So I have a little example on my laptop here, if I can get it to fire up. If you think about if you have just an index fund in the S&P 500 and you're letting it sit there and letting the dividends reinvest, what's the probability of your returns being positive if you hold it for 1 year? And what about if you hold it for 2 years? And what about if you hold it for 3 years? You probably won't see this. I'll actually flip it around just in case anybody zooms in. It's like a bunch of blue graphs that are like almost 100% all the time, but I'll just read it out to you. So over a 1 year period, you have like a 79% chance that the stock market, including your dividends, is going to be up. And if you have just a two-year holding period, you're already up to like an 88.7% chance, and so on and so on. And you get up to like pretty much 100% within like 10 or 11 years that you will be ahead in stock market investments. And then usually it's much more than just break even. Usually it's a pretty high percentage. You average like 7%, 6 or 7% after inflation with the stock market, because the economy tends to grow in the US even now, and its craziness is still a very business intensive country where a lot of profits are being made. So if even if you're old, like, and I'm a good example, right? I'm 51 years old. A lot of people at my age would be shifting their portfolio over to bonds closer and closer because they're like, I'm going to retire. Some people retire at 55. I leave mine pretty much 100% in stocks because volatility doesn't bother me at all. And then when you run the simulations on stocks versus bonds, you still end up better off with a very, very high percentage of stocks. So taking this all the way back to Jesse's point, I would say that you can kind of assume something better than bonds when you're calculating the discount rate for your future value of Social Security payments, but you don't have to, right? Like if you're not into all these numbers and all this crazy math, which I know a lot of people aren't, including people that are very close to me, all you really need to know is that Social Security is probably going to help you quite a bit if you're in the situation where you're trying to do a lean FIRE. And especially if you're over 40 already, don't assume it's going to be zero, because otherwise you're going to work too long, because you're going to assume that you're not going to get any Social Security, and then you're going to have less fun in your life. And my real goal is that everybody just has more fun in their life. So
okay,
that's my main rebuttal, even though his point is well made. And if people understand his point, then it's going to be very educational, you know, because there's a lot of depth of financial knowledge just in that, in his piece, which is a good job.
I'll assume some counterpoints to have an interesting conversation. So in your article, the thought is you don't actually need the Social Security to pay for your expenses. You don't need it to live. Is that basically right?
Well, yeah, because if somebody is considering an early retirement, we're assuming they already have a lot of savings, you know, multiple years of expenses already banked up, and they're currently working, because that's the definition of someone who's considering retiring. And then the question is, like, conventional financial advice is like, just keep working right until 67 so that you can take the maximum Social Security payment, and then might end up working too long. Mm-hmm. So that's what I kind of...
Gotcha. Okay.
The situation I'm assuming.
Okay. So a little bit different than what I thought. So... And you're comparing it to, basically, you're like, take the money sooner and then invest it.
Yeah. Like, first of all, take it sooner and don't worry about foregoing these higher numbers, because it all kind of works out the same. And I used the number, like I used the example of investing it just to kind of prove the point. Most people would typically spend it if they actually need that money.
Yes.
And if they don't, then I don't know, if they're still earning money like in a job, then it makes sense to not start taking Social Security, because there's all these clawback clauses and everything that I did not get into in the article.
Right.
But yeah, it's fine to take it. It doesn't make a huge difference either way. But my main point was, you should never like force yourself to work that extra 5 years just to get the higher Social Security payment, unless you absolutely need the extra savings.
Gotcha. We'll see where it goes. I was going to say, I don't want to dig in too deep. I was like, I feel like it's two different things, because if someone is continuing to work, then if it's a job they hate, and we talk about this all the time, if it's a job you hate, like, find something different if you can. Not everybody is in that situation. Most of the audience is like post-fi or like more advanced and more in a privileged position, I guess, and have more options generally. But anyway, I'm feeling like if it's someone who would use the cash flow, then they wouldn't be investing it. They need the money to live, and then they'll have to figure out some other stuff, work a part-time job or whatever, which could be totally fine. But that aside, it's an interesting thought exercise. And I mean, for you personally, and maybe some of our friends, where it's like, maybe we oversaved a little bit. I mean, are you going to take your Social Security early and invest it because you don't need it? And then you're like, oh, like, I may as well take advantage of this extra cash flow, invest it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. The answer is yes. I probably would do that. Mm-hmm. As long as my income at that point, like 62 years old, if I have really low income, such that drawing the Social Security benefits does not like push me into a higher tax bracket,
right,
then I probably would pull it in, even though I'm still going to have like millions of dollars of investments sitting there quietly,
right,
that aren't generating taxable income. I would still pull the Social Security, and I would use that either for my cash flow, or if I had more, if it was more than I needed, I would invest it. And then later on, I can pull back more money from my, my bigger savings whenever I want to, because I do believe the math. You know, I do believe that I'm better off taking it earlier and investing it because of this stuff we talked about with the blue bar graph that I showed.
And then the other part, like the whole thing is a risk management analysis. And at the point where we're talking about it, it is really just a thought exercise where you're like, can I optimize this a little better? And then you also have to throw in taxes, and then like you're talking about taxes and tax brackets, and then like the growth, and then the potential other taxes you may have to pay in the future. So it gets a little fuzzy. And at the point where it's like, is this really worth the hassle? I mean, set it up and you're like, I'm good with the returns. I'm not going to fuck around with too many tax things if it's a huge pain in the butt. You'll do the big stuff as well as you can. And then again, it's an interesting thought exercise, but
yeah. It's not a huge difference either way though. Like, I think that's the real point. And then the most valuable time this article is meant, the people it's meant to help is like, let's say you've got not quite enough, like you need $1 million of retirement to meet your needs, and you have half a million and you're 62 years old. That's the real point. And my point is, hey, you might as well just start drawing the benefits at 62 and then you'll leave more invested instead of delaying it until you're 67 and then using up more of your investments for that first 5-year period or whatever it is. And you could still debate, like Jesse would say, no, hold out, live off your own investments and then take the higher payments from Social Security. Mm-hmm. That's a fine strategy too. It doesn't make a huge difference. But for some people, they just really like the feeling of getting a monthly paycheck because they're really protective of their investments. And my numerical argument is that you statistically would still probably win in that situation too. It could be a market crash that makes you slightly not win, but I always gamble where the odds are in my favor rather than against, you know. So that's the real situation. And I was coaching someone who is in that exact situation, and I made like a changed version of their situation in that article to make it a little bit more clear.
Got it.
But I apologize, everybody. We got like way into the weeds here.
People love this. I was going to say, I'll do one more level, although not deeper, but just another deep thing. We, in this household, we have, Elizabeth and I have different risk thresholds. So she's more conservative. So we have like rebalanced to more bonds. Like we had more than what I, basically it's a more traditional, I think we might be like 30% bonds. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is really important to her. Security is a very important thing. So through negotiation and working with the advisor, like we arrived at that. And I think before that, I mean, I maybe only had like under 10% in bonds, but I rebalanced a little bit. So we won't have as much like pure growth, but potentially, not guaranteed, maybe less volatility, which helps us sleep better at night. And if she's sleeping better at night, then I am too, right?
Yeah, so. Right. Another thing that's very similar is, especially because you're homeowners, I don't know if you keep a mortgage on this house or not, but in general, having a mortgage while you're retired is like a reverse bond, because it's like you're paying a fixed interest rate for a fixed number of years. And in exchange for keeping the principal of that house like out invested. And so I typically, and this is like also illogical, it just helps me sleep better at night. I typically keep my house paid off. And that's like having a bond in a way, because it's like I've put the whole purchase price of the house into paying it off. And then in exchange, I get free rent, which in my new house is probably worth like, I don't know, $3,500 a month. Mm-hmm. So it's like I bought a $3,500 a month income stream by purchasing this house, because now I don't have to pay rent. Yep. Anyway, in a way, that is kind of a bond for me, right?
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Some people, like Carl, keep their house mortgaged because they like to be more leveraged and they like the, you know, the tax deductible, low interest loan to invest more.
Interesting. Yeah, great point. Because that is one area where people, they're like, oh, you should. I mean, there's great debate. And some people, I mean, actually a lot more people than you would think do have their homes paid for and no mortgage. Mm-hmm. So we do have one here. We got one when the rates were a little lower. So it's nice to have. All right. Good discussion there. And we'll link up to Jesse's article. And when he was on the show, I'm pretty sure he was on the show. He's a good guy. I like Jesse. Okay. And last question for today is your annual expenses, Pete. So you've talked about this over the years. I think, you know, the Tim Ferriss podcast episode, it was like 28,000, but that was what, 8-9 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we gave an update maybe a year ago or so, but just curious if you know your expenses for like last year and then where they might be going. And you've alluded to additional cost through the move.
Yeah. The strange thing is that my core expenses have gone down over time. Like even in the Tim Ferriss situation, I still had a young child at that time. So there were more expenses related to his schooling and feeding him and all this other stuff. And now that has reduced. So in theory, and then the last time I added up my expenses, it was about 25,000 once again, even in like the year 2024 or something roughly, that I published a blog article about this. And it really doesn't change because the only thing I spend money on is like groceries from Sam's Club and Costco, get my clothes there too, unless I get good stuff like the Mile High Fi t-shirt, you know, and then I just pay for utilities in my house and construction materials for my renovation. So I have like a very, very cheap lifestyle. I don't want other people to compare it too much because
right.
They might be higher, but that's because I have this very unique set of likes, you know, like I bike everywhere. So like, I just have to buy a new bike chain every 3,000 miles. Like it's just really, everything's really low cost and it's totally fine to spend more.
Right.
And I eat really good food, but it's when you're buying it from a Costco, that just doesn't add up to very much. And then the one thing that I didn't include, like I did increase my expenses to, is by moving to a much larger house. Like my new house is worth about 1.5 times as much as my previous in terms of the market value. So temporarily, because I bought this house using a margin loan against my investments, I'm paying the interest on the whole purchase price of this house. So this house is like $750,000. The interest on that, I had a little bit of cash around at the time. So I have a $600,000 loan, which is kind of hilarious for Mr. Money Mustache. So the interest on that is about $3,000 a month. So right now I have my expenses went up by $36,000. Like they were 25 and now we added 36 on top of that.
Yeah.
But then that's going to end as soon as I sell my other house, because that one's worth like $500,000. I'm going to put that chunk of cash right into paying off most of the new house. And then I'm going to sell little chunks of shares, and like any money that I earn is just going to pay off the new house. Going back to what we just said, which is I prefer to have a paid off house, whether it's rational or not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then my expenses are going to be right back down to the similar number, other than I have like higher property taxes. So that's like a marginal increase in my cost of living. So it's like, to make the answer short, in my new, more expensive lifestyle, I'm probably going to be, instead of like 25K base expenses, I'll be like at 30.
Okay. After you pay off, because it would be like 60 something,
oh, yeah.
65. And then, I mean, you have right. to furnish it. There's a bunch of other shit.
That's right? True. I kind of did that already. And a lot of it was just like trading and moving stuff around between my two houses. So I didn't really spend a lot. I spent like $2,000 on new furniture. Everything mm-hmm. else was existing or stuff I'm building or whatever.
Yeah.
So it is really hard to, like, because I do such weird stuff, it's not always comparable to a normal person's life. Like I also have the co-working space. So I spend a lot of money on like materials for that, but it's really my business that's doing that.
Right.
So yeah, it's overall though, I'm surprised at how little inflation there really is mm-hmm. in my core life.
Follow-up question on that is groceries. That was one of the bigger areas. You don't eat out a ton. We don't eat out too much.
Yeah.
But like cost of meat, a lot of groceries have gone up. Have you noticed that? Like, I mean, even for us, I mean, we don't track it specifically, but just me shopping, like I see like beef is whatever, 20% more expensive. Chickens, like all proteins are a lot more expensive. So have you noticed that or?
Not really. It's true. If you like a lot of steak, which I know that as a meat master, you probably buy more steak than me. That stuff is crazy expensive, right?
It's
even at Costco, it's $25 for like a little teeny couple of steaks. So, and I try to avoid that anyway. It's kind of like, I like steak, but it's the most eco, you know, intensive. It's the most environmentally intensive of any meats to eat. So like, I think of that as a treat, you know, I don't eat it every day. If we're just talking about grocery items, like chicken is still embarrassingly cheap. It's like 2 something a pound for chicken breast at Sam's Club. Mm. And that's way cheaper than when I was a kid in the 1980s, like even in nominal dollars without inflation adjustment.
Right.
So groceries are cheap. Eggs are like, you know,
they're cheap again. Yeah.
Even organic, nice brown free range eggs are something like $3 a dozen at Sam's. So it's like, it's hard to spend a lot of money on groceries. You can only eat so much. I eat a lot of this blended nut thing for breakfast that I make, my breakfast bars.
Okay.
Those are all like high calorie, high protein, relatively cheap ingredients.
Yep.
And salads every day. So I probably spend only like a few $100 a month on groceries.
Okay.
So like 3,000 something per year. So it's just such a, you know, even if it doubled because of some kind of crazy inflation, like our country would go into like a civil war before my grocery bill became significantly expensive because people don't like when the groceries go up.
Right. Very good. All right. Well, thanks, Pete. And remember, if you want to get your questions in, buy me a coffee, check out the link. If you want to check out this shirt that Pete has, I have a Etsy store. I make about $4 per shirt. It's print on demand, so they're not super cheap. But if you want a cool shirt to show off at your next Camp Fi or Economy or whatever, you can check it out there. And then you can sign up for the email list as well. So thanks a lot. And Pete, should people go anywhere, check out the Fi Collective for a virtual membership, or what kind of thing you got going on?
Yeah, if you haven't heard about it all at all yet, I really like the idea of people who are into meeting more Fi people. Just look at our website, theficollective.com. You can see what we're up to in Longmont. And now that we have remote members all over the place and people are coming in to meet each other, especially coming in July when everyone's going to spend the month in Colorado for all the Camp Fi events that are happening here. Even if you're not attending a Camp Fi, then July is kind of a fun time to be in Colorado. So,
And is that like if people are going to Camp Fi and they want to hang out at the Fi Collective, do they need to be a virtual member? Have you guys?
Yes.
Okay.
If you want to actually come into the building and stuff, you'd want to be a member. So like we have the remote membership that's $100 for the whole year. And then you join the Discord server and you get to know people. And then it's going to be like a long, you know, basically a month long shindig where everyone's circulating and respectfully having parties and cleaning up after themselves. But yeah, it is nice to have a home base, and our building downtown is a good place because it's got indoor and outdoor space and should be lots of people meeting each other.
Very cool. And for the virtual members, there's virtual events, I believe every month, which you can get more information on the website. I think they should just go there. Yeah. To check it out.
It's all, okay. All the info's there.
All right. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Fi podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So I think I saw you a couple weeks ago, but what have you been up to the last few weeks since then?
I've been pretty much on self-imposed lockdown in my new Denver house, just cutting pieces out of my new garage and rebuilding it into a workshop, which is like all this drywall and insulation and electrical work, and kind of ridiculous, but also very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I've been listening to Reacher audiobooks while I did this. So I think I've burned my way through like six Reacher. It's like having a series that never ends because there's about 20 of those things.
Yeah.
So I've been very, in an interesting world. It's good to be back in civilization now.
Very good. Yeah. It's funny. You describe it as a lockdown, but it's like you're doing some fun stuff. And those I love that series as well. I'm caught up. I read the Kindle versions over the last 5 years or whatever. Wow. So I'm sad. I'm like, there's no new ones for me to, I have to wait until Lee Child publishes more. Yeah, they're great audiobook wise too. So,
I mean, it's very formulaic. It's always just like, there's a crime and he's investigating and he meets a random beautiful woman and hooks up with just that one. Just, he's like monogamous through the course of one book, but over the course of like a series, he gets around a little.
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious how similar each book is.
Yeah, so formulaic. They do mix it up occasionally after a handful. Maybe you'll start getting to some of those where the timeline isn't chronological.
Oh, cool.
So, not to spoil anything, but...
Yeah.
But they change it up slightly, but it's still exactly what you described.
Yeah. You know what we should ask is if any of the readers are into manly action fiction like this, or just action fiction, it doesn't have to be manly, but we would love recommendations for stuff that's kind of similar pace to Reacher, and we could just continue getting addicted to another series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I love to start at the very beginning and then just keep going through the whole chronology there.
That's funny. You've been through all this. So we're going to have to talk about some of these old goldies that never made it to the TV show.
Yep. And then for us, we were on a road trip. So we just got back a few days ago and it was pretty intense. We went down to Dallas for the PanCAN, the Pancreatic Cancer Purple Stride, which you helped, or did you swing by for the event that we did? Anyway, you were around, Pete, at that point.
I remember being.
So we met up with my family down in Dallas, did the Purple Stride walk down there, which was pretty cool. We actually, thanks to anyone that donated out there, we placed third in the family and friends. So I like accepted an award on the stage and have like an official picture and stuff like that. So kind of cool, and got to see my family. And then we continued on to Hot Springs National Park. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty cool. We, you know, we're ticking off the national parks. Interesting overall, and I'll talk about the park some other day in depth, but so humid down there. Holy fuck. I mean, it was rough. It was not too hot. I mean, it was maybe in the 70s when I would go out in the morning to walk Georgie. Again, road trip, so we brought Georgie, but I'd walk out within like 15 minutes, I'd be totally soaked. I was taking like 3 showers a day just to rinse all the sweat off, and my clothes were, just.
It takes a while to get used to it.
I sweat
when I go back to my homeland, which is really a steam bath in the summer in Canada.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're used to Colorado, you're going to be a bucket for the first while until your body's like, okay, I know what to do.
Yeah. So you adjust, you're able to adjust.
Yeah, for sure. You get used to humidity. Just like people in Texas say like, oh, it's not bad. You know, like an athletic person. I've met a lot of my blog readers who live in Houston. They're all like, I don't know why everyone's complaining. I still ride my bike to work and stuff. And I went to Houston in August one time and it was like record temperature even for there. So it was like 104 actual degrees plus the humidity. And that was quite a challenge, but it was just fun to see how much your body can sweat. I would just like, I wouldn't even bother starting with a shirt. I would just like leave my friend's house with no shirt and it would just be like,
shooting just from pouring. All
pores. Yeah.
So I'm from Atlanta and it's roughly the same, super humid, very same kind of climate. I don't think I ever adjusted. I just got a little more used to it. So I think I just knew the expectations were you have to change your clothes all the time because they just get soaked. Sometimes you have to wear a shirt when you go to work, stuff like that back in those days. But I must have shown up to so many meetings just like wet because you had to walk to another building to get to the meeting or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's in the same boat. I'm a sweater though. I sweat a ton. So anyway, it was a good road trip overall. And the other thing is all these storms. So we spent a lot of time like trying to dodge the tornado watches and stuff as we were driving. Wow. There's a lot of crazy footage out there. Tons of tornadoes like in the area that we were driving through. So